Hey, this is just a quick note about our sponsor, Privado, the premier enterprise privacy platform, purpose-built to bridge the gap between privacy and engineering. Its privacy code scanning solution embeds privacy, compliance, and governance into the product development lifecycle and empowers privacy and security teams with unparalleled visibility of sensitive data flows and the insights to find and fix privacy vulnerabilities. You can leverage Privado's data flows, dynamic data mapping, privacy assessment automation, and real-time visibility of privacy issues. Enter the era of proactive privacy and transform privacy from business blocker to business enabler. To learn more, go to privado.ai.
You can infer, for example, somebody's race just based on their zip code. If you're making decisions about who can get credit, their federal law on credit is that you can't use race as a criteria, but you might end up completely incidentally, because the ML, you might incidentally be using things that are proxies for that. And so if we have tools that can identify these risks in the models, now we can start to see, can we develop workable laws that actually achieve our goal of privacy, as opposed to what we're doing now? Because what we're doing now, particularly with the advances in ML, it doesn't work anymore. It's not achieving its goal.
Welcome everyone to Shifting Privacy Left. I'm your host and resident privacy guru, Deborah J. Farber. Today, I'm delighted to welcome my next guest, Steve Hickman. He's the founder of Epistemus, a privacy-first process design tooling company. And Epistemus provides tools that can check your process design as the privacy rules change, so you know if you need to fix your process before the rule changes go into effect. Today, we're going to talk about the need for having a privacy ontology in addition to a privacy taxonomy and the types of privacy modeling tools that can solve current privacy scalability problems. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you for having me.
I am so glad you're here. I know we've had previous conversations, and I've really been fascinated with kind of your approach to thinking about the problems with scaling privacy today in large organizations. I know most recently you worked at Meta, and you also left to start Epistemus to scale privacy. And why don't we start off with, like, you know, a little bio from you. Like, you have such an interesting background as an engineer. Just give us an overview of your background and how you came to focus on privacy process design rules at Epistemus today.
Okay, sure. And I have a confession to make. You know, I've done so many different things. I have to read my own resume to remember them. So but it turns out that matters, because I worked for quite a while as a consultant in a lot of different industries. And one of the things that comes out of that is this, you begin to see the same problem in many different ways. You know, I worked in, besides aerospace, I worked in retail, helping Target set up their first website. And I worked in telecom a number of years, and pollution control, and many other things. And what happens is, when you see that many different things, you start to see the abstractions behind them. And this is where ontologies come in, because ontologies are about conceptual abstractions. Okay. So I did a lot of different things in a lot of different industries. I ended up, actually, just before Meta, I ended up in aerospace. I was working at Honeywell, and I was the technical lead on a project for the military, US military. And that actually ended up providing a lot of the technical foundation for what we're doing at Epistemus. Now, what does that mean? Well, two things. One, your tax dollars at work, so that's good, I guess. And the other one is, it's military grade, if that matters to you. So after that, then I went to Meta, and it was kind of interesting that I was being recruited by them, and I did not have a Facebook account. Just so you know, I'm kind of a private person to begin with. I did not actually have a Facebook account until I had to get one to accept my job. Okay. But I was being recruited, and it so happened that the person that was talking to me initially was the director of the privacy organization. And I was just very frank with them. I said, here's where I'm at. I'm not really interested in working at Facebook unless it's on privacy, because privacy matters a lot to me. And part of that had in my career, my prior life, it's just, I guess it's part of it being an introvert. I'd also gone to law school while I was at Honeywell. My focus there was on intellectual property. I'm not a practicing lawyer. So I had become aware of things from a legal point of view then. And so when I was being recruited, if I'm going to work here, this is the organization I'm going to work in. So I went and started working in their privacy organization. And all of the background that we have informs each step that we take in life. And so as I was looking at what was being done in the privacy organization, the problems that they were attempting to solve, all of this background of working in many different industries and dealing in abstractions and working then on this military project, which also had quite a bit of actually abstractions and the tooling to support them, I looked and I said, if you're going to solve this privacy problem, you really need all of this stuff. And so I spent some time there and tried to help them as best I could. Meta is a very large organization. I worked with a lot of people who are very smart. They have a lot of momentum. That momentum was not going in the direction that I thought was necessary to solve the problems that they needed to solve. And so I thought, well, I'll just go solve this on my own. And that's where Epistemus came from.
Thank you. No, that really does help connect the dots, because we weren't doing privacy for many years, right? So, but bringing your entire varied background to the privacy problem, it's amazing how you were able to kind of do pattern recognition to understand, like, what are the problems you're continuously seeing and then apply it to privacy. I mean, I know we're talking in generalities because we haven't gotten to the meat of the conversation yet, which is privacy ontologies. But let's see, before we get to that exciting solutions that you're working on related to privacy tooling, privacy by design and engineering, let's unpack some of the major challenges that you've seen when it comes to scaling privacy. So in your opinion, why has it been such a challenge for companies to get privacy right at scale?
Fundamentally, I think the challenge comes from the fact that software developers like to write code first, and privacy, if it was thought of at all in the past, was an afterthought. And as a result, there's also this other tendency that most software developers have, and that is that they don't bother to document their code. Okay. And so what happens then is that you lose all of the semantics, all of the thought process that was going on when the code was being written. A lot of that information gets lost. Once the code's written, that developer walks away. They're doing something else. It's not well documented. And so when you look at that code and you're trying to figure out what does this mean, that becomes difficult. And what you see, and this is what I saw at Meta, and you see the same thing with, you know, tools out there, you know, Privado is one, and there's other companies that do this data mapping where companies will try to reverse engineer, they'll do code scans and try to reverse engineer and identify, here's what we think the semantics are, which in Meta's particular case was a real challenge because they have multiple technologies they're using. You know, the front end's written in JavaScript, the back end's written in Python, there's some C++, and then they bought Instagram, and all of Instagram stuff is written in Rust, and there's little Java. And so when you're trying to do this analysis, not only do you have to scan the code and try and figure out what it means in one particular language, then you have to try to connect the dots between, okay, this function is written in JavaScript, and then stuff gets written into a data store and it's read out in Python. And what concepts, you know, when you're trying to track a concept through this entire data flow model, it's difficult because of all these language and technology changes. And so they were putting a tremendous amount of work into this and trying to account for this while the code's being written. Counting for it while the code's being written is better than trying to backtrack, but you know, the conclusion that I came to was it's really better just to do it right the first time. A phrase that I like to use with people is, if you don't have time to do it right, how will you ever have time to do it over?
It makes a lot of sense, especially when you're using, you know, whether you're coming to market and you're using VC funding or you want to build it right. You don't want to just, you know, build it just for product market fit, get out there and then find out that you have to re-architect everything. Cause then, you know, you didn't plan that into your product roadmap necessarily. And it just becomes compounded technical debt that, you know, someone eventually has to address, or, you know, it's an uphill battle because everyone wants to work on revenue generation rather than cleaning up problems in the architecture that you created because you didn't think about things early on. So totally agree.
Yes. And privacy has a unique set of problems in terms of technical debt, because there's not just standard technical debt, if there is such a thing. You create a problem, you know the problem exists, you know you need to fix it. The issue with privacy is sometimes the problems are created not by you, but because the law changes and something that used to be okay is no longer okay. And so, you know, you can go through this whole process of you do the code scans, you figure out and say, okay, I know what this data means. I've figured out the semantics. I've analyzed how this is flowing through my process. I know what the functions are. I know what the purpose is. You figure all that out. But then if you change jurisdictions or the law itself changes, you got to do it again, assuming you even notice. And so there's this additional dimension it's beyond the kind of debt that you get with just you wrote sloppy code.
Right. And sometimes it's like you don't even know where to start to clean it up, right? I mean, just even cataloging where are the problems is a big effort in and of itself. Then you have to actually fix it. And so one of the reasons that I am so excited to have you on the show is that in our previous personal conversations, I've heard you speak about privacy in a way that I had not heard anyone else. And it had been giving me a great like aha moment, you know, kind of almost like forgetting about the technical stuff for a moment and just going back to more of like a socio-technical kind of, you know, how do we approach problems kind of thing. And we had discussed why having a taxonomy for privacy in an organization is important, but it's insufficient to managing privacy at scale. You've stated that first and foremost, an organization really needs to have a known and understood privacy ontology. And so this is where I really want to expound on this, as really where I want to focus our conversation for most of the episode. And we'll start with why. Why is a privacy ontology necessary for scaling privacy processes? What is an ontology?
Let's start with the definition, because that's important. So a taxonomy, most people are aware of that. It's a hierarchy of concepts. And if you took biology in high school, you know, it's like genus and species, that kind of thing. General, specific, and you can have as many layers as you want. And so, and that's a good starting point. Where you get with an ontology is more than that, because you get not just general specific, but you also get relationships like whole part or the role that a particular piece of information plays in a given context. And so you're able to work with these other kinds of relationships when you're dealing with various concepts beyond just the general specific that you get with a taxonomy. Okay. So that's really key, because if you think about how software development has evolved. In the 1970s, we figured out that having data structures was a good idea prior to that. And here's a variable. I got this one variable. I got this one other variable. I got this other variable. And then we said, okay, well, we want to group these variables together. And so we started giving them similar names, like, you know, first name and last name or something like that, but they were still not grouped. And then eventually we figured out, we need something better. We need actual structures of data. And so an ontology is basically that. It's something that enables you to create these data structures and the relationships between them. The key distinction that you have with an ontology versus what you have in source code is that in an ontology, I don't care about the physical storage that I'm using. I don't care if, let's pick money, okay, the concept of money. I don't care if I'm storing that in a floating point or a string or an integer. What I care about is that it's money. In many cases, I don't even care if it's dollars or euros or pounds or whatever. I don't care about units. I just care about the concept. And so it's that conceptual level is where the ontology lives. And you can have that not just for individual concepts, but entire structures of concepts. So if you think about an address, we might say, okay, it's city, state, zip if you're in the United States. Well, again, I don't necessarily care about the storage, the details. I just care about these underlying concepts. And by defining these at this conceptual level, now we've got something that gives us the flexibility. It gives us a couple of things. One is, first of all, that's where the rules live. If you think about how the law is written, the law doesn't care about those details either. So,
well, it depends on the law.
Yes. I mean, it does depend on the law. Some do. Yes, I agree. But in the cases where it doesn't, then you're not dragging along detail that's unnecessary. And maybe I should word it that way.
That makes sense.
And so there's that. And then you have the ability then later on, if you wanted to associate this, if you either want to do code generation, you know, for example, you can add that other detail later on if you want to. But if you work with things at a conceptual level, then you're not tied to specific technologies so that in the case of a company the size of Meta, where you're using many different technologies, you don't run into this impedance mismatch that occurs because you're trying to keep track of things and you're switching technologies and you can't figure out, okay, is this field in this data structure written in, you know, in JavaScript, does it match this other field that's in a Python structure? And so you end up with a common language that can be used across all of these. And it also turns out that becomes very helpful, again, going back to the rules, that you're not forcing your lawyers to learn how to code, okay, because they don't care about those code level details either. What they care about is whether or not you're following the rules.
So by having an ontology, it's kind of bringing the business together so that all the various stakeholders have a common language, it sounds like, to talk about privacy at a more abstracted level before you get into the more technical applications of data and approaches and architecture and all that. Is that what you're saying? Is that how it's...
Yes, exactly. And having a common language is really, really important. Communication is difficult. I remember years ago, I was in a conversation and in some meetings for some project, and there were 8 people in the room. 4 of us were software developers and the other 4 were mechanical engineers. This was for a manufacturing tool that we were trying to develop. And I came out after 4 hours trying to figure out if we'd actually communicated with each other. And they were all engineers. It's just some of them were software and some of them were mechanical. You can certainly see that the further people get apart in terms of their backgrounds, the harder and harder communication is. And so having a common language becomes really, really valuable. It has the highest level of endorsement. I'll put it that way. Okay. If you remember the story of the Tower of Babel, this is the whole issue that God gets irritated at the Babylonians about, saying, you know, if they speak the same language, nothing will be impossible to them. And so I can't think of a more ringing endorsement.
No, it's a good point. And it just kind of shows that how, you know, even back then, like that, how having to take the religious stuff out of it, just societally, how important it is to have common ontology for so many things, for understanding and communication between different groups of people, and how if all of a sudden everybody spoke different languages, like the Babel story, how hard it would be to scale things across society or societies, for sure.
Yes.
So let's get into a little more, I don't want to say specifics, but some kind of use cases that help crystallize what we're talking about here. And talk to us about how Epistemus is using semantic modeling for rule checking, and, you know, how this helps with scaling privacy as part of this ontology approach.
Okay. So there's two fundamental things that we're doing. And one is that is the ontology identifying the semantic concepts, you know, for the data that's being used. And then the second part of that is, once you've identified this, defining your process, how what the data flow is through your process at this conceptual level, using these concepts that we've already agreed on. And if you think about in a process, basically you have two things going on. You have some kind of function that has a purpose, and then you have some kind of intermediate storage for information where data is going to be at rest. And then, so you may receive data in, it may go directly into storage, or it may go into a function that has a purpose. And then eventually it gets stored, and then it may get read out again and processed for some different purpose, and it gets written out somewhere else. And that you can continue that read and write process cycle however many times you need. If you do this at a conceptual level, okay, then all you care about is, conceptually, here's the data structures, the relationships that I care about that's going into a function. Here's the purpose of this function, and here's the data that comes out. You don't really care about anything else, because then what you can do is the rules, you know, whether they're legislated or regulatory rules, whether they come out of your privacy policy, or maybe they're contractual, like, you know, you've gotten data from a third-party broker, and so you've got some contractual limitations on your use of data. Wherever the rules come from, now you can take those rules, you can encode them in the tool, and actually evaluate this process design that you've got against those rules. And you can see, am I breaking the rules? You know, I'm good, I'm not good. You may end up with some situations where it depends. Of course, that's the area that lawyers love.
Well, I don't know if they love it, but it's the area they live in, for sure.
It's certainly the area they live in. Yeah. And so what happens is, if you're breaking the rules, that's an engineering problem. If it's an absolute rule and you're doing something in your process design that breaks it, then the engineer just needs to go fix it. If it's one of these, it depends areas, that's where you need to bring in the legal team and say, okay, what do we need to do? Is this really a problem? Maybe the law is just a little bit vague, or, you know, how do we address it? But the whole idea there then is that because the tooling allows you to evaluate these rules against this process design, the process design is all independent of, you know, specific code implementation. You know, if the rules change, you can just update the rules and reevaluate as part of your standard build process. If you go into new jurisdictions and there are new sets of rules, you just add those in. And so you can be constantly up to date. And in fact, you can do this evaluation before the rules actually take effect. So if for some reason the rules are changed and what used to be okay is not, you're going to know that, and you have time to fix your process before it becomes an issue. Does that make sense?
It does. It's definitely part of the shift left mindset. De-risk earlier on, mm-hmm. fix the problems in engineering to reduce your compliance burden later on. Like, absolutely makes sense to me. So maybe talk about how this would fit into the maybe agile development process. Like, how would an organization, you know, is Epistemus good for any sized org? How does an organization fit this into their current agile processes?
Okay. So there's a couple of things. Yes, potentially any sized organization could use this tooling. Now, having said that, very small organizations. I have one customer, for example. It's this one person shop. She's a healthcare concierge. She's not a developer. She's never going to be a developer. Okay. So for people like her, she's not going to learn how to use the tooling. Instead, I've worked with her. I'm doing the design work on a consulting basis, based on her input, and say, okay, here's your design. And then let's evaluate, in her case, it's HIPAA, saying, hey, what HIPAA rules are you compliant and that kind of thing? And, you know, or is anything being violated? And so in very small business scenarios, we fully anticipate that we'll work with consulting partners. You know, it could be large companies like Ernst & Young or PwC or small, there's a ton of privacy consulting companies. You know, if you go to the IAPP tech vendor list, there's 400 companies. Many, 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 many of those are consulting companies. And so I've been in conversations with a few and continue to do more of that to work with them as consulting partners with very small businesses. Larger businesses, if you've got your own in-house developers, you're probably going to want to learn how to use the tooling. And so, sure, we can train you how to do it. We can kind of get you kickstarted and let you take over. We can help you as much as you need and let you go on your own as much as you want. That's up to you. Very large companies like Meta, they could use this tooling. They're probably going to develop stuff in-house. I'm a realist, okay?
Yeah.
So...
yeah, the really large companies, kind of almost all of them take the perspective that, you know, we are so unique, so big and unique in what we do that there's going to be nothing off the shelf that we can just come and customize appropriately. We'll need to like just build our own. Yeah. So I'm not surprised you feel that way. I would advise any kind of company that. It might be hard to ever sell to an enterprise like them.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for designers, architects, and developers when it comes to creating and implementing a privacy ontology, taxonomy, and semantic model to get started in their orgs, right?
Well, one of the things that going back to the whole common language, I think is very important. And I actually think that IOPD would be a great organization to do this, is that we should have...
That's the Institute of Operational Privacy by Design.
Yes,
yes.
Correct.
Okay.
It would be a great organization to create and manage a privacy ontology. Now, like the W3C has some stuff. There's been some attempts in this direction in the past, but really, we should have a common language. And it really makes sense that a standards organization should be leading that so that not just epistemists, but, you know, epistemists, Privato, you know, Privacy Code, Big ID, whoever these companies are, we should all be speaking the same language. Because part of what that ends up enabling is tool interoperability.
Mm.
Okay. And also, it's the end user doesn't have to keep switching their mental model each time they're going from one tool to the next, because that just would result in a lot of mental gear grinding. So that's the first thing. Now, having said that, for example, Epistemus Modeling Tool, EMT, and the pun is intended, by the way.
I love it.
Is... comes supplied with a base level ontology that's predefined, that the rules are in all of the, like GDPR and CCPA and things like that, those rules are defined against that base ontology. So that's already available so that end users don't have to go and try and figure that out. Okay. This is going to probably get a little bit technical.
That's okay.
When defining an ontology, there's a couple of things in order to make sure that it's usable, you need to be able to do. And that is, one, you need to accommodate the realities that sometimes people are going to call the same thing by different names. And so you need to support aliasing. Okay. So that's just a kind of a practical thing. And so that whatever tool you have has to be able to do that. And, you know, EMT can do that. Since I knew that was an issue, I just built it in. Okay. So that's one thing. Another thing is that the ontology will be the union of all the different things that you need to represent, but not every user will need everything. And so you need to have a way for people to use only slices or subsets of the ontology for their particular application. And so that's also built in. Now, for example, in EMT, the way we do that is, if you're familiar with SQL for relational databases, there are select statements in there. And you can say select this field, this field, this field off of this table. And the idea there in SQL in databases is that you get back a actual data. You know, you're querying a database, you get back actual data. We actually use the same syntax, but what we're doing is saying, here's the subset of the concepts from this conceptual data structure that I want to use in this particular function. So it's not, you're not querying a database, you're just taking a slice off of your ontology. Does that make sense?
It does.
Okay. So you need stuff like that because, like I said, the ontology has to be the union of all these concepts, but you don't want to force people to actually use everything because in many cases, they don't need to.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, loyal listeners. The Shifting Privacy Left podcast is seeking sponsors who want to help educate our growing community of privacy engineers. Position your brand in front of privacy engineers, architects, developers, researchers, and privacy tech buyers. Insert a 30 to 60 second ad like this one into every published episode of the podcast. This is dynamic content, after all. Feature your new product, an upcoming conference, a sponsored special deal, endless opportunities. Email sponsorship@shiftingprivacyleft.com for more information on our sponsorship package. Okay, let's get back to our engaging privacy conversation.
So it's also about making it simpler to make choices. So you're only surfacing at the higher level the important choices that you need to make. Is that?
Well, right. I mean,
correct.
Yes. The fundamental challenge with tooling, particularly tooling at this abstract level, ease of use. It's a mindset shift. If developers are used to writing code in JavaScript, Java, whatever, and now you're saying, okay, this is similar, but it's not identical. Okay. And so you want to make the tooling use familiar paradigms where possible, but also identify all of the pain points, all of the places where the differences could cause them to stumble or be less productive than they could be. You know, and that's true for any tool. I mean, this is not true just for this, but it's certainly true for this because you're asking people to think at a more abstract level. Now, the payoff here, one of the nice things about generative AI is that we are not going to write code in the future like we have in the past. And I don't know if you've looked at things like GitHub Copilot. There's a lot of different tools out there now where all you have to do is you go into your favorite code editor and you write a comment, says, you know, this function does X, and then GitHub Copilot will just generate the code for you that does what you just described. Okay. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. But what that means is, as you know, as developers, we're not going to write code the way we used to in the past. And so adopting tools that work at an abstract level, that work at a semantic level, is really where we're going to end up. And so EMT is developed with that in mind so that you can work at this abstract level. And then when it gets to the point of actual code, a lot of that code is just going to get generated.
You don't have to focus on that part because it'll just be auto-generated from the prompt.
Right, exactly. Because that won't be where the fun is anymore.
Makes sense. So I really like use cases that help crystallize a larger idea. And so I'm going to mention some other privacy tech companies right now that are in the privacy engineering space, because I want to really get clear on where Epistemus's privacy first tooling can fit in with mm-hmm. other tools on the market rather than replace them. What you're suggesting is not, you know, buy Epistemus and then you don't need these other tools. But it's also, I think, at first glance, not clear, as we have all these new privacy engineering platforms coming to market that do different things. I think if we go through this exercise where I will mention a particular type of tool or platform out there and what it does, how you could kind of wrap Epistemus's privacy first tooling around these other tools. Does that sound good?
Makes perfect sense.
Okay. I think it'll make sense to the audience too, as it helps to make clear how you can help with privacy and scaling it. So first, I'd like to start with like data discovery and mapping platforms like a BigID or a Sacuvi. How does Epistemis's process design tooling work with like, you know, discovery and mapping platforms?
Okay. So for companies like that, and in particular, those two companies have a lot more than just that. And so I want to talk about some of the other things that they
do. Sure, absolutely. They do more than just data discovery and mapping, but like, you know, that's kind of how we're branding them. Because once you do the discovery part and the mapping, you could do so many other privacy, security, and governance things. So go ahead.
Right, right. So those tools or those companies, the tool suites from those companies can be both input to, and it can be a symbiotic cycle. So for example, if you're doing data mapping from one of those, using the data mapping tool from one of those companies, then that can be input into building your basic conceptual model in EMT. Because anytime you do this kind of mapping, you know, at some point, human beings got to look at that output and say, yeah, that's correct, or no, I need to adjust this or whatever. And when you're doing that, you are effectively building your data conceptual data model, which is the key pieces that EMT uses. Okay, so in that sense, those tools can provide input into EMT. Now, the other side of this is if you look at those companies and they do other things like ROPAs and PIAs and stuff like that, the output from EMT can then be fed into those tools so that if you need evidence for a PIA, then the results that you get from running the rules in EMT can be the evidence that you use for those PIAs. Or in the case of you've got a process to handle consent management or ROPAs or something like that, EMT, because it's a process design tool, one of the things that it will do is it will detect, oh, you know, you need to have the ability to process ROPAs. You need to have consent management. I don't see it in your process anywhere. Well, then what you can do is that we'll have it. We don't have it yet, but the idea is that you'll have a graphical editor that, to draw out your process design, and you'll be able to just drop widgets in. Okay, I'm using BigID, so I'm going to use their consent manager. I'm going to use their ROPA tool. And you're just going to be able to drop that into your design and saying, okay, here's my ROPA tool. It's BigID. We're going to wire it all up. Here's my consent manager. It's, you wire that up. And then what can happen is that EMT, as part of his output, can actually generate all the configuration information you need to configure those tools so that they are doing what they're supposed to do. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah. So what about platforms like Privado, who is also our show sponsor, yes, which scans a company's product code, like their product code,
yes,
and then surfaces privacy risks in the code. And they also detect processing activity for creating dynamic data maps. You know, how does Epistemis's process design tooling work along a platform like that?
Well, you know, Privado, I think, is a great example of what I like to think of as insurance. Okay. And there's a very positive relationship between that kind of what you're doing with that code scanning and what EMT does, because one of the things that we know about human beings is that they don't always play by the rules. Okay. So you can have a design tool. You might even generate code from your design tool, but you really should have a way to check the actual code that's out there to make sure it's actually following the rules that you thought you were following. Okay. So you can use, for example, just like with if you're just scanning your data stores, you can use something like Privado in a code scan to do an initial pass to create a semantic model and your basic process design, okay, that would be used in EMT. So it can, that part can be input into EMT. And then you can do all the rule evaluation in EMT. And if you choose to do, as you update things, you might want to standardize, or if you decide to switch technologies, you know, this was written in JavaScript and we're going to switch it over to Kotlin, or instead, you know, we're going to do this in TypeScript now instead of JavaScript or whatever. You could switch technologies if you want regenerate code in a different technology that goes back out into your code base. Well, then you can have stuff like Privado there doing those checks on the actual code base again to say, okay, well, we verified this at design level, but what did we actually get? And does it actually match the design? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Thank you. And then lastly, what about a company like Privacy Code, Michelle Dennity's company, which transforms written policies into consumable tasks for developers and business teams? So for instance, they have a library of privacy objects, implementations for agile privacy, like success criteria and sample code. And then they deliver also meaningful metrics on how the privacy engineering process is going. You know, how would Epistemis's process design tooling work alongside a platform like Privacy Code?
Okay. So, you know, so Privacy Code scans your privacy policy, generates all these tasks, puts them out in Jira. Here's what you need to do. And, you know, basically, here's the rules you need to follow based on your privacy policy. So those then, you know, what we want to do is actually turn those in to executable rules in Epistemis so that we can actually verify that you've actually done what Privacy Code told you you were supposed to do. Okay. So then as you do your design, then we've got those converted. So in that sense, Privacy Code becomes input into EMT. And so then we can evaluate those rules against this design you've built. And we can even use, for example, the sample code that they have. You know, I mentioned earlier about like with Big ID or something, the drag and drop. We can do a similar kind of thing with these privacy objects that Privacy Code has so that you can insert those into your process wherever is appropriate. And then when you, you know, if you generate code or if you're just, you know, you're just evaluating against the model, you can say, okay, yes, this is what the rule was. Is the model up to snuff? Is it actually following these rules now? So we, you know, we can take that from just being something in Jira to actually verifying that you've done what you were supposed to do.
Got it. That, and that's so helpful too for teams. Yeah. So where are you in the current product development process? You know, are you seeking collaborators? Are you looking for POCs? Are you, you're at the point where you're selling the product? You have the audience, you have the floor right now, you know, who do you want to collaborate with?
We're very much interested in finding pilot customers, people who proof of concept. You know, right now, the initial focus is GDPR. You know, here we are close to the end of September 23. The goal is to be by the end of October to have a rough cut on articles 1 through 45 of GDPR, which are really the only ones that are addressable with this approach. And then once that's done, then we'll start looking at US state law and which, in terms of the kinds of rule sets that we support, the basic modeling is all there. And, you know, we need to improve the documentation and improve usability. I'm very, very much interested in identifying people who want to give us feedback. Right now, it's the feedback is important. It's free to use. Just, I want your feedback. And we're interested in identifying potential consulting partners, people who are in the privacy consulting business and are looking for ways to help their clients. Because, you know, if you're a privacy lawyer, you know, you're a consulting company, you want to make sure that you're thorough. You don't want to drop the ball and somehow miss something. But you also want to focus your energy on the areas where your expertise is super valuable. And so the idea is that EMT can make sure that you're thorough. It can, you know, can evaluate all the rules, make sure that you're not missing anything. And then you can focus on the areas that really matter. And so we're looking for people who are interested in those kinds of partnerships. I'm not going to lie. It's still rough. I mean, this is very early days. So it's sneak peek time, but I'm very much interested in collaboration with people on multiple levels.
Excellent. Well, I hope that you get multiple people ringing you up to talk about how we could make a privacy ontology, you know, eventually standardized too, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, so I would think that at some point, whether you're leading that initiative or you were working with others in some organization that leads that, that we can get an industry standard around a privacy ontology to really bridge that gap between privacy engineering and legal, GRC, you know, just the business in general. So tell us more, you know, I know you've got some interesting privacy tools that you plan to ship in the future. Tell us a little bit about what's on the roadmap before we close for today.
Okay. Well, the one thing that I'm most excited about right now, it has to do, I call it wargaming. And for those people who've read Daniel Solov's piece, Data is What Data Does, and I think it's just out in preprint right now. So he really hits on a very important point there, and that is that the current approach to privacy law is fundamentally flawed. And
he wrote the book on it. When I took privacy law in 2004, it was the book that he wrote along with my professor, Paul Schwartz. And to this day, that it is the same, you know, updated, of course, but the same legal, you know, same law book that is being taught in most law schools is there. So just putting that out there to everybody who's listening here.
Yes.
So proceed with Dan Solov.
Yes. I did ping him earlier today because I want to get his feedback on this, but we need a different approach. And so the foundation that EMT provides is not just about implementing what's currently the law, but it's a generalized foundation where we should then be able to war game new rules, new approaches to rules, and see what happens. You know, can we, for example, in a different one of his papers, he talks about inference, and he mentions like the inference economy and whatnot, and the challenge of, you know, it's not just what you know about something, but what you can infer about them because of advances in ML. And so part of the issue here is, can we detect the risk to people in the models? Because we see, well, you've got all these different pieces of data that are all flowing to the same place. We have statistical evidence that says, for example, you know, statistically, we know in the United States, if you know someone's birthday, zip code, and gender, you can identify them, the specific person, 85% of the time, with just those three pieces of information. Okay. And so if we can look at our models and say, okay, we've got these different pieces of data floating around, they all flow together, there's a risk occurring here that information will be inferred that was never consented to, but could end up mattering. You know, and that could be something like, you can infer, for example, somebody's race just based on their zip code. If you're making decisions about who can get credit, their federal law on credit is that you can't use race as a criteria, but you might end up completely incidentally, because the ML, you might incidentally be using things that are proxies for that. And so if we have tools that can identify these risks in the models, now we can start to see, can we develop workable laws that actually achieve our goal of privacy, as opposed to what we're doing now? Because what we're doing now, particularly with the advances in ML, it doesn't work anymore. It's not achieving its goal. So the idea there is that EMT is being built with a fundamental foundation that will enable us to start doing this kind of wargaming and start detecting these kinds of patterns. And I'm very excited to see where that leads, because we really need to, if at all possible, we need to get out in front of this, because the technology, right now, technology is stripping away our privacy extremely rapidly, and we need to figure out a way to catch up. So,
yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, and that it's akin to finding vulnerabilities in code, the way that, you know, it's red teaming, basically another type of red teaming, but in the yes. AI space, and it's about trying to basically test and make sure that your rules will not be broken, I guess, right? So yeah. I think that's really exciting. as many listeners here know, because I bring it up often whenever it's relevant, my fiance is a hacker, right? So this is like a constant conversation in our household, talking about, you know, addressing risks in code. We need to do it in AI for bias, for fairness, for figuring out how do you make a trusted product, right? And so if you want people to trust your products in the future, especially and not believe that it's like eroding your privacy, being able to say that you're wargaming new rules or at least a type of test to make sure that it meets certain criteria before you'd ever ship it, I think is essential. So kudos to you for looking forward and seeing where technology is going and then, you know, what we need to get in place quickly in order to be able to even make decisions across a business that involve legal risk and engineering, right?
Yep.
And it's really hard to get those things matched when in legal, there's a lot by design, a lot of things are left as generalities when they're defined, you know, reasonable security, right? What's that? How do you design for reasonable security, right? What's that testing criteria look like? And so being able to at least have a discussion where everyone's understanding and on the same page at a high level, I think is essential. So Steve, thank you for joining us today to talk about privacy ontologies and privacy process tooling and the exciting work you're doing at Epistemis.
Thank you. Thank you. It's always fun.
Yeah, indeed. Until next Tuesday, everyone, when we'll be back with engaging content and another great guest or guests. Thanks for joining us this week on Shifting Privacy Left. Make sure to visit our website, shiftingprivacyleft.com, where you can subscribe to updates so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found this episode valuable, go ahead and share it with a friend. And if you're an engineer who cares passionately about privacy, check out Privado, the developer-friendly privacy platform and sponsor of this show. To learn more, go to privado.ai. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday for a new episode. Bye for now.